Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. It was Voltaire who said, "I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." And those who subscribe to modern liberal values are supposed to adhere to that idea. Free speech for all, regardless of message, unless there's a direct threat of violence to individuals. But as has been part of the national conversation these days, part of the faction, which Trump calls the alt-left, follow a different path. The anti-fascists, or Antifa for short, argue that given the horrors of Auschwitz and Treblinka, the destruction that fascists have historically caused, white supremacists should not be granted the right to express their ideas in public, in part because, Antifa argues, had they been more restricted in the 1920s and 30s, for example, we may have been able to bypass the atrocities that ended up happening in Europe and elsewhere. We saw this logic play out in Charlottesville when Antifa arrived to fight, armed with weapons, motivated to block white nationalists from rallying and having their say, even though they had legal permits to do so. With me now to talk about Antifa, what it stands for, where the movement started, and where it's headed in the United States today, is Mark Bray, lecturer at Dartmouth College. His new book is called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a little bit of history before we come to the present. Mm-hmm. And the present, by the way, includes today. There's a news story that crossed a little while ago. The Phoenix New Times is reporting that one group associated with the Antifa movement has called for an anti-fascist and anti-colonial contingent against Trump's rally that's scheduled for tonight in Arizona. So we'll see what comes of that on this very day. But I see from your book, the Anti-Fascist Action Group Combating Fascism in Italy and in Germany was the first group to use the name that's now become common for anti-fascist organizations around the world and the derivation of the shortened term Antifa. Was this violence against the rise of fascist violence? Was this a movement against free speech? What was it in Germany and Italy in the 1920s?
Right. So some of the first groups to use the name were in Germany in the early 30s, a group called, of course, the equivalent would be in German, but Anti-Fascist Action. There was also a French group in the 20s that had a name, Comité d'Action Antifasciste, or something along those lines. And the original context was leftists of all stripes, communists, socialists, and anarchists, essentially trying to fight back against the violence of fascism and Nazism, because we have to always remember that fascism and Nazism are not incidentally violent, they are inherently violent. That is at maybe the most core value of what it's about. And so self-defense was certainly part of it, but it was also about organizing more broadly and trying to inoculate the broader society against the kind of lies that Nazism and fascism promoted.
And how far did it ever get in that context? Because certainly, you know, people look back and think, oh, there really was no popular resistance to the Nazis, for example. It might have failed anyway, but there was none.
Well, there was. There certainly was, but certainly much less than there should have been, right? So that's the dichotomy. It wasn't really until 1934 in Vienna when the right-wing government there tried to take over and there was a popular resistance that the left started to realize in Europe that this was an existential struggle for existence. Even in the early 30s, the German Communist Party thought that when Hitler got into power, they would have their turn right after. Their slogan was, first Hitler, then us, but they never got their shot. And so the anti-fascist argument more recently is that you don't let fascism take even the first step towards normalizing itself, towards ascending the ladder towards power, because once that kind of slippery slope starts and you don't resist it with your utmost abilities from the beginning, it could become too late.
So in the U.S. context and in the Trump era context, it really came into public view around when anti-fascists violently disrupted Milo Yiannopoulos from Breitbart at UC Berkeley back in early February. Can you trace a little more of Antifa as it emerged in the United States?
Certainly. So while it is always important to remember that all forms of struggle against white supremacy have existed in what we call now the United States back since, you know, the beginning of colonization and slavery, specifically Antifa-style politics emerged in the late 80s when the Anti-Racist Action Network was created on the model of anti-fascist action in Britain. Some of the early organizers thought that the language of anti-racism made a little more sense in the American context than anti-fascism. And by the 90s, that had grown into a network that stretched across the U.S., Canada, and Latin America with hundreds of chapters doing all sorts of work, not only combating explicitly fascist groups, but working to defend abortion clinics and doing other kinds of work against the far right. Now, more recently, in the late 2000s, there was a bit of a shift towards the language of Antifa imported from Europe, some of the more the styles of the European movement. And then we can see that that has grown slowly but really exploded with the Trump campaign and then his victory.
By the way, let's get the little pronunciation thing out of the way. I've heard it so many ways, and you're saying Antifa.
Right. So like in Spanish, you'd say antifascismo, Antifa. So that's sort of a way that, that the Europeans say it, but I don't get in the habit of correcting pronunciation.
So some would say what distinguishes the Antifa from liberal anti-racists are Antifa's willingness to use violence when they deem it necessary and their lack of thinking that free speech is a value as important as liberals might think. Are those two main distinctions?
Well, so the main distinctions are, number one, they believe in self-defense, and they see anti-fascism as fundamentally an activity of self-defense. That needs to always be clarified, because without the onslaught of fascism and white supremacist violence, there would literally be no anti-fascism, neither now nor in the past. The people who participate in these groups are also union organizers, environmental activists, and all sorts of leftists across the political spectrum who would really much rather be putting their time into the productive work of building a new world and not having to deal with neo-Nazi skinheads. The other part is that they see the struggle against fascism as fundamentally a political struggle, as a struggle against one of the most destructive forces in human history that, if allowed to fester, could potentially become the seeds of another worldwide disaster. Now, I'm not someone who thinks that we're on the precipice of another, you know, Nazi regime, but the lesson that they learn is that you don't allow it to even become possible. You stop it from the beginning. And in terms of speech, they simply see it as a political struggle, not as a liberal regime of rights where you try to arrange a situation for neo-Nazis and their victims to coexist. Instead, they see it as a political struggle.
My guest is Dartmouth Professor Mark Bray, author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, and Peter in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I think on a moral level, I have nothing against, and I support the views of Antifa, but on a strategic level, I think all it does is provide sympathy for the nonviolent and resistors to being seen as if it provides the sympathy for the other side, and it's to see the pro-racist KKK guys as equivalents, like both sides are to blame. And from a recent poll that I'd seen, There's some evidence that that happens. I think what the success of the civil rights movement in the South was the very strict nonviolent resistance, not just going along, but tremendous resistance. So I think who is seen as a victim is really important. It may be unfortunate that it has to boil down to that, but Perception can become reality.
Peter, thank you. It's a central question,
right,
Professor, because, you know, the Antifa violence allows white supremacists to depict themselves as victims because they're being denied the constitutional right to freely assemble. In fact, I think baiting Antifa for political gain seems to be part of their explicit strategy on the right, yes?
This raises a lot of important questions. So to take a step back, I am a historian, so I tend to refer to history. We can see that inherent in fascism and neo-Nazism is to be seen as a victim. They always consider themselves a victim, even when they take power. Inherent in it is the Jewish conspiracy is against us, the Red Menace is against us, everyone's against us. And so we can also see that inherent in neo-Nazism and fascism is violence. So you can show up to counter-protest neo-Nazis nonviolently, and certainly no one is calling upon everyone to physically confront anyone or to physically defend themselves if they choose not to. I think that the peaceful movement and the movement of self-defense can coexist and complement each other. And we saw that in Charlottesville, where many people who showed up to commit acts of civil disobedience, such as Cornel West and other clergy members, found that unexpectedly they were being charged at by neo-Nazis wielding clubs and shields, and we're very grateful that there were some people willing to stand in between them and prevent serious physical injury. So,
but that's supposed to be the police.
Well, it wasn't, right? So we can see that certainly in the era of Black Lives Matter, when police are in some cases much more of a threat even than neo-Nazis when they're killing Black people on a regular basis, the notion that Black people or undocumented people or queer and trans people can always count on the police to protect them is part of the anti-fascist argument that self-defense has to be a community activity because you cannot count on them to do it. So that's the other side of it as well.
Anthony in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Brian. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I make no pretext of being a scholar like the professor is, but I would like him to actually define fascism. Mm. Because it seems to me, and again, I'm not a scholar, it seems to me that fascism is more a leftist philosophy than everything else. And I think that a lot of these people in this Antifa organization don't really even know what fascism is and just use it as a brush to paint what they consider to be the right. But if the communists were so comfortable with Hitler coming to power because they felt he was the next step on the way to a real leftist agenda, how can you say that all people on the right are fascists? And I see now a strategy of the left is to paint everybody who had any sort of semblance of support for Trump. Now we're white supremacists, which is absurd. So I'd like to have your thoughts
sure.
on that.
All right. A lot to address there. So first of all, what is fascism? Fascism is notoriously difficult to define. We could have a whole show about it. But I think the key difference that shows why fascism is fundamentally an ideology of the right rather than the left is because it is an ideology of class collaboration rather than class conflict, meaning that the goal is not for, as socialists argue, for the workers to control the means of production, but rather for the state and the nation to guide how the productive forces of labor and the overseeing forces of industry coexist. Ultimately, in practice, though, it ended up being essentially a capitalist dictatorship. So that is one of many examples of how it's fundamentally different. Now, in terms of the historical question of Germany and Hitler and the communists, to clarify, the communists did not see Hitler as a positive next step. They rather thought he would be a fad or a trend that would happen briefly, he would fail in government, and then they would get in afterwards. So that's another part to clarify. But no one is saying that all Republicans are fascists. No one is saying that all of the right are fascists. Fascism is something specific, but also Antifa will respond to the broad far right in general. And to me, it seems like your average Republican will be well served to distance themselves from white supremacists and make it very clear that they reject this kind of politics. And unfortunately, that's not always done.
Anthony,
neither is anybody on the left. No significant left or left mainstream politician is that willing to jump in and say the more radical elements of the left are clearly wrong. They don't jump up and say this is clearly these people in Berkeley who are burning the buildings and stopping this right winger from speaking. They don't jump up and say they're incorrect. They tacitly approve of that.
I don't think that's true. I think, you know, Bernie Sanders, when that guy who was a Sanders volunteer shot Congressman Scalise, immediately denounced it. There's the whole liberal movement that is aghast that the Antifas are using violent tactics inherently aghast and also aghast at the political implications, just as most of the people who are conservative in this country are aghast at the white supremacists. I think both things are true on both sides. But Anthony, let me follow up with one thing you said. When you say it's...
So now you have a group that has a permit, and I don't agree with these people.
Yeah.
I kind of have I can argue about this statue pulling down, and we could talk about that, but that's not the issue. I'm not sympathetic with these white supremacist people. They're narrow-minded. They're idiotic.
Good.
And they have a neurotic or a pathologic problem. That's their problem. However, they have a permit. They're in a park. The Antifa people, they show up loaded for bear. They went there specifically with an axe to grind, and they were going to grind it violently. If they stand on a corner and wave their banners, that would have made the same effect, but that's not what they wanted. They wanted a confrontation, and they got it.
Anthony, thank you. I'm going to leave it there. And Professor Bray, is that your understanding of the sequence of events in Charlottesville?
I have a little bit of a different understanding of it. And I think it's grounded in understanding the history and politics behind fascism, neo-Nazism, white supremacy, and resistance to it, where I think it's incumbent upon us, regardless of our opinion about different kinds of tactics, to understand that when we see confrontations, we should understand them politically. And that is one of the lamentable outcomes of Charlottesville, is that so many people were pushing back against the notion that we should simply sort of look at the acts being taken and carried out and see the context and the politics that historically the self-defense of anti-fascists, the self-defense of Jews and other victims of white supremacy is not the same as the violence of fascism.
We'll continue in a minute with Mark Bray, author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, and more of your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Dartmouth professor Mark Bray, author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, which looks at the history and current state of the anti-fascist movement, including the violent elements of Antifa as seen at Berkeley during the Milo Yiannopoulos appearance, and, of course, after the book was written, in Charlottesville last week. You have what you call in the book five historical lessons for anti-fascists. One is fascist revolutions have never legally succeeded. I mean, fascist revolution, basically fascists gain power legally.
Right.
Another lesson is it doesn't take a lot of organized fascists to sometimes develop a really powerful movement. And you say we can see that recently with the rise of Golden Dawn, the fascist party in Greece, for example. One that I find really interesting is, for ideological and organizational reasons, socialist and communist leadership was often slower to accurately assess the threat of fascism and slower to advocate militant anti-fascist responses than their rank-and-file membership.
Right.
Is that a lesson that can be applied to today?
I think it is. So we can see historically that some of the communist and socialist party leadership in Italy and Germany and elsewhere looked at the conflict against fascism excessively from a macro perspective and felt like they could weather the storm of having a fascist government come into power and then having it leave power, as we were discussing earlier. On the ground, people in their everyday lives could see the violence of fascism and Nazism, could see the blood on the streets, and were much more eager to respond and to take up self-defense, and in some senses sort of proactively. And so I think today we can see that rather than looking to leaders, looking to politicians, that people need to assess circumstances where they live in their everyday lives and do what makes sense for them to organize collectively with their neighbors, community members, people in their religious groups, to do whatever kind of response they think is appropriate.
Eric in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how are you? I wanted to ask the professor to comment on the op-ed in the New York Times this Sunday called How to Make Fun of Fascists by Moises Velasquez-Manoff, basically saying that by using violence, you play right into their hands of fascists. But isn't there a third option between nonviolence and and violent resistance, but really to mock them, to make them look like fools rather than try to resist them violently?
That's a great question. So I certainly think satire and humor can play a very powerful role in the response to fascism, to try and, you know, take their claims of being the strong men and turn them on their heads. But I think that it cannot be the entirety of what we're talking about, because we can see that actually similar debates and discussions happened in the 20s and 30s, that Charlie Chaplin did his famous impression of Hitler in The Great Dictator, but later he actually, to some extent, regretted it because he thought that simply making Hitler into a joke in some ways did not accurately reflect the threat that he would become, right? Say what you will, Hitler was not just a joke. And even more recently with Charlottesville, I think you can see that a lot of the social media response to the Friday night torch-lit tiki torch march of the khaki white supremacists was making fun of their allegedly, you know, failed sexuality, of the fact that they can't get a job and so forth. And, you know, that can be funny, but simply responding to it as a joke, I think, obscured the real physical danger that this represented. And we saw that the next day it wasn't as much of a joke. So I do think that we can do that, but it should be one part of a much broader struggle that includes all sorts of responses.
Malcolm in Bernardsville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Malcolm.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Professor. I actually just graduated from Dartmouth in June. So it's kind
Congratulations.
Of fun. Thank you. My comment is just, you know, you opened the segment with talking about the historical, you know, Antifa Italy and Germany in the 1920s and 30s, and how, you know, they're sort of saying that if they had been allowed to silence, you know, Nazi propaganda, et cetera, that maybe bad things in World War II, the Holocaust might have been avoided. But I'd love to hear the comment on, you know, the cost, the sort of cost benefit analysis of that proposal, in terms of, you know, like where does the line get drawn, slash, you know, the long term implications of having that sort of policy.
Great question. So certainly there is a discussion to be had about under what circumstances what forms of organizing should be opposed and prevented from expanding. A lot of times in the media, that question is discussed in the abstract, in the analytical, discussing it out of historical and political context. In my book, I discuss 100 years of anti-fascist organizing across Europe and North America, and I document that the responses are pretty specifically to fascist and white supremacist and anti-Semitic kinds of politics. And usually when those kinds of local organizations that these neo-Nazi groups are successfully defeated, the anti-fascist groups tend to disband and return to being union organizers and environmental activists and what have you. So I do think that, you know, a lot of times fascists and neo-Nazis draw the line for anti-fascists through their aggression and through their attempts to normalize racism and anti-Semitism. So it is response to sort of a tangible context. And back in the 20s and 30s, there was little ambiguity when you have Mussolini's black shirts going around pouring castor oil down the throats of unionists. There was a little ambiguity as to what the enemy was in that context, but that is certainly an important discussion to have.
Malcolm, were you trying to suggest that maybe as a white male at Dartmouth or elsewhere, that there's already this sort of censorious environment for more ordinary conservatism, and that you're worried about where that line might be, you know, in the name of preventing a true fascist rise?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say censorious or conservatism. I'm, you know, what I felt at the beginning of my Dartmouth career, trying to get involved in sort of, dare I say, radical activist organizations, especially in environmentalism, but also in terms of, you know, the racial climate on campus as a white male, was just that because I, being a white male, not having experienced life in America as a person of color, therefore wasn't really allowed to, you know, make a valuable contribution or a contribution that held any weight in discussions or in like planning and stuff like that. And that really troubled me and sort of alienated me and made me a lot less enthusiastic about being, about participating in those organizations. So that was more what I was saying earlier.
So where are you at today politically?
Still very liberal, but, you know, I'm not, didn't turn me into a white nationalist or anything, I think I just took that as something that's happening amongst young people on college campuses and kind of forgave it, I think, and you know, continue to be very much on the left.
Thank you for your call. Benjamin in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Benjamin.
Hi. So I teach social studies at a public school, and something that we talk about in class a lot is that really effective movements are oftentimes effective because the conversation happens on the terms of the people who are looking for change. And it seems like this conversation, really the conversation should be that, you know, Nazis and white supremacists were marching on the streets in a, you know, mid-sized American city, and the president basically said that was okay. But instead, there's these conversations about who's Antifa, are they good, are they bad? And it seems like if you want to have effective change, the conversation has to be more on the side of what's right, what's wrong, and who, what side are you going to be on? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I do think that the conversations about how this relates to Trump certainly have been had, but your point is well taken. Certainly, we can't discuss what happens without looking at the questions of right or wrong as understood politically and understood historically. But I do think also that the history of fascism and white supremacy shows that being clear, having a clear moral conscience is essential, but we also need to put that into practice. And so discussions of how to put that into practice, whether we agree with different methods or not, I think are essential. And I'm sure you would agree that looking at the history of the civil rights movement, you know, that these conversations are important to be had under all circumstances.
And can I ask, so for instance, there was a gentleman, I think his name was Anthony, who called earlier. And he clearly seemed quite disgusted by what was happening in Charlottesville and disgusted by the white supremacists. But he also seemed kind of turned off by the aesthetic of Antifa. Mm-hmm. And isn't there a concern that maybe a more moderate, maybe less politically active, I mean, I don't want to speak for this guy, but that's the sense I was getting, a more moderate, less politically active person who I would say is, you know, a lot of this country, is going to be turned off from what is essentially a movement that is in the moral right?
Yeah, that's another good question. I mean, the reality of social struggles, as you well know, is that there's always going to be different factions, there's always going to be different looks, there's always going to be different tendencies. In this context, anti-fascists are predominantly socialists and anarchists and so forth, and they're going to view the political struggle differently from, you know, Democrats and progressives. And so, in my opinion, one way to look at it is, in reality, there are going to be these different views. There are going to be these different factions. In my perspective, since we can all agree that the threat is neo-Nazism and white supremacy, how can we coexist? How can we both be at a demonstration without getting in each other's way? And no one is suggesting that everyone should join this group or that group. I think, you know, we can look at it with a certain flexibility as anti-racist, broadly speaking.
We're just about out of time. Can you give us a quick demographic profile of Antifa activists in the United States? Are they mostly male, mostly young, mostly college educated or not? Is there a pattern?
Well, you know, the people that I spoke to for my book, I interviewed over 60 anti-fascists from North America and Europe. Most of them did not really share much personal information, so there's very little that I can actually say. It is more diverse than the usual portrait portrays it. There are people of different races and genders and ages involved. I think in general it does sort of trend young, but that is true of radical social movements in general. Beyond that, it's really hard for me to say.
And trends white, would you say?
I think that it's hard for me to say. A lot of the people I spoke to, I don't even know their racial identity, so I can't really comment.
Mark Bray, lecturer at Dartmouth College, is now the author of Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.